Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Without my husband, I cannot live for a moment. If you want to eat my husband, it would be better to eat me first. For without my husband, I am as good as a dead body. In the Vedic culture, there is a system known as sati, or sahamarana, in which a woman dies with her husband. According to this system, if the husband dies, the wife will voluntarily die by falling in the blazing funeral pyre of her husband. Here in this verse, the feelings inherent in this culture are expressed by the wife of the Brahmana. A woman without a husband is like a dead body. Therefore, according to Vedic culture, a girl must be married. This is a responsibility of her father. A girl may be given in charity, and a husband may have more than one wife, but a girl must be married. This is Vedic culture. A woman is supposed to be always dependent. In her childhood, she depends on her father, in youth on her husband, and in old age on her elderly sons. According to the Manu Sangita, she is never independent. Independence for a woman means miserable life. In this age, so many girls are unmarried and falsely imagining themselves free, but their life is miserable. Here is an instance in which a woman felt that without her husband, she was nothing but a dead body. Yajayam kriyate bakshas tarhimam kada purvataha najivashe bina yena kshanam cha mritakam yata. Without my husband, I cannot live for a moment. If you want to eat my husband, it would be better to eat me first. For without my husband, I am as good as a dead body. Om Agyana Timarandasya Ginanjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Vansha Kalpa Tarupyascha Kripa Sindhu Pya Evachi Patitanam Pavani Pyo Vaishnavi Pyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasari Gaur Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So please give me blessings so I can say something appropriate. Hare Krishna. It's a new feeling here. I'm on a low seat. It's different. It's better. It's more humble, right? Actually, the Bhagavatam is to be honored, right? That's why when you give class, Bhagavatam class, if you sit on that elevated platform, it's to honor the Bhagavatam. It's not to honor oneself. So, let's just quickly recap where we are in the story. The story is that Saudasa has been cursed by Vasishtha Muni to be a Rakshasa. So now the curse is taking effect, and Saudasa, he sees a Brahmana with his wife, and he desires to eat the Brahmana. In spite of the pleas of the Brahmana's wife, Saudasa eventually eats this Brahmana. So today's verse is the rather lamentable situation. Poor wife is pleading with Saudasa, but because he's afflicted with this Rakshasa mentality, he's not even going to listen to these pleas of the Brahmana's wife. So her attitude is, if my husband will die, it is better that you eat me. So Prabhupada, he makes the point in the purport that this is the attitude within Vedic culture of the ladies, that they are so devoted to their husbands that they would rather die than live without their husbands. It's quite amazing, this mood. We cannot really understand it in modern culture because we're brought up very differently. We have a very individualistic mentality. As one devotee said, we're hyper individuals. Meaning that ultimately we only care for ourselves and we aren't going to sacrifice for anyone else. Ultimately we cannot create, we cannot develop relationships that have any depth. It's said in the 12th canto, Dampachi Biruchir Hetu, that in Kali Yuga, sexual attraction is the force that determines marriage. That's all it is, sexual attraction. And how long does that last for? A few years. For some people it lasts a few months. For some people maybe a few decades, nothing more. And then what? Then it's misery. But in Vedic culture, relationships are deeper than that. They're not based on sexual attraction. And here in the purport it's said that a woman can be given in charity. I mean, how many ladies would like to be given in charity? I mean, it's not thought of these days. I mean, in India maybe it can be done, but in the West it's very rarely done, even in the Hare Krishna movement. And I know a couple of examples. Well, I wouldn't say they were quite given in charity, but I know a couple of examples where the relationship was not based on choice so much. It was more about, we'll have a Vedic marriage and we'll just kind of, the wife serves the husband like this. Now, both those marriages actually ended up in divorce, I have to say. Seems to be there's a problem putting this into practice, and I don't personally recommend it, but the ideal, we should live by the ideal. The ideal is something that we should value. It's not that we disrespect Vedic culture if we're having trouble applying Vedic culture. There's a difference, you see. Sometimes devotees, they like to almost disrespect the culture by saying it's not a good idea. Or they try to relativize the statements of the acharyas. For example, in today's purport, there's a statement, the Manu Samhita says that a woman should never be independent. So who knows this verse? You know this verse? Na striyam svatantratam arhati. It's coming from Manu Samhita. Now, sometimes, as I say, devotees, they like to find a way to get around those statements because, well, sometimes it's for good motive. They think, well, the Hare Krishna movement, in order to spread, they should, they should be more accommodating to the needs of women. And if we preach that women should not be given independence, and this is bad, it's bad for the movement. We're out of touch with the modern world, and therefore it'll be difficult to spread Krishna consciousness. You heard this before? It's quite a common statement, right? Now, let's address this issue. It's like a tension. There's a tension between what Srila Prabhupada says and what some devotees feel is appropriate to say in public, and even amongst devotees. You know, sometimes some of the ladies, they get upset to hear these statements. And I've seen different ways that devotees have tried to get around these problems. Recently, I read an article by a devotee, a scholarly devotee, and he was looking at the statements in the Srimad Bhagavatam that appear to be denigrating to women. And he gave some examples. The one is, there's an example where Kashyapa Muni is speaking to Diti, and he's describing how a woman's heart is like a razor blade, and she will even kill her relatives for her own self-interest. So this devotee was arguing. He said, actually, you should understand the circumstances behind this statement, because Diti, she had served Kashyapa Muni very nicely, and then Kashyapa Muni then said, offered her a boon. And then she had said, I want a son that will kill Indra. So this was not a nice statement. And Diti, this is a clear character flaw on the part of Diti. So this devotee that wrote the article, he was arguing that actually this is not a statement about women in general. And Kashyapa Muni was referring to his wife Diti. He would never have said this to one of his other wives like Aditi, who is more pious. So I was reading the article and I thought, this is reasonable. But then I went to the purports of Prabhupada and I looked at the purports of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and it turned out that the purport was not saying this is only applying to Diti. Prabhupada was actually making it clear this is the nature of women. So what the acharyas say was somehow or another, it stopped the argument that this devotee was making. Now, his intentions were good. I accept that his intentions were good, but the fact of the matter is, if you want to be honest, the acharyas are saying this, and not just, you know, you can't just say it's the circumstances of the Bhagavatam. There's another example that was given in the article. It's King Pururava and Urvasi. And Urvasi speaks to King Pururava, and she says similar things. She says things that describe women as being as before, like they're prepared to even kill their relatives for their self-interest. And this devotee was arguing that, well, Urvasi, she was from the heavenly planets and she didn't want to be married to King Pururava, but she agreed to do so, and so she was speaking to King Pururava in such a way as to discourage him. So this wasn't actually the nature of woman. And once again, I checked the purports, and this Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that she is describing the nature of woman. That was all this. This is a very short purport. So how do we deal with this? How do we understand this? Anyone got any ideas? One thing that's very dangerous is to read the purport and then to categorize a person according to that according to the statements of the acharyas without looking at the actual qualities of the person. I mean, I don't know if... I think everyone will agree. In my experiences, there are trustworthy women and there are untrustworthy women, and the same for men. If you actually look around you, I mean, who do you trust? I wouldn't say... I don't notice that women are untrustworthy and men are trustworthy. Now, I've heard different arguments on this. One suggestion is, which sounds very plausible, is that... someone's looking... maybe someone disagrees, I don't know. There's one argument I've seen. I think it's quite reasonable. And that is to say that in previous ages, in a more Vedic culture, men were a lot more advanced, a lot more morally advanced. They had a lot better character than they have now. So the kind of the argument there is that in Kali Yuga, men are flops. They're not very good anymore. Therefore, men and women are just the same as each other. Kind of something along these lines. I mean, it's. I don't know. I haven't seen any actual reference to this, but it's definitely plausible. But actually, even we see that in the culture, the women have actually declined in character as well. And Prabhupada discusses this elsewhere in the Bhagavatam. Today's purport mentions use the term sahamarana. So that's it's a Sanskrit term. So saha means, what does saha mean? With, and marana, death, yes. So saha marana is another word for sati. It means that the woman dies with the husband. So Srila Prabhupada explains that actually this is perfect, this mood. But he describes how as Kali Yuga progressed, because we have in the first canto there's the case of Dhritarashtra's wife, Gandhari. She's a very chaste lady. So she entered the fire when Dhritarashtra died. So in this connection, Prabhupada explains that actually this sati rite is very, very good, and that it was practiced in India. And Prabhupada explains that even he witnessed this in 1936. He saw this one rare instance. There was a very devoted lady who entered the fire. Now the idea behind this is the fire of separation is more intolerable than the funeral fire. That's why the wife enters the fire. But Srila Prabhupada explains that actually as Kali Yuga progressed, women became less devoted, therefore they didn't want to do this anymore. And what was happening? The relatives were pushing them in the fire. You know, it's dishonorable. You know, you have to die with your husband. It's good for our reputation. Plus, we don't want to look after you, right? Something like that. Anyway, so that's, as Prabhupada correctly points out, this was criminal. And so what the British did, they outlawed this practice. You see? So, which is good. We don't want to fake it, right? The rule's there, but the devotion has to be there. But as I say, Prabhupada said it's a very good system. Now, there's... even says that, for example, in the Kshatriya kings, they would sometimes have many wives. Now, if the Kshatriya died on the battlefield, all the wives would enter the fire, the funeral fire. Imagine, it's like we have to try and understand what's going on here. There's almost a feeling that women are like little add-ons. They're kind of like, they don't have independence. They're just kind of like attached to their husbands, and then they just kind of like, they're burnt when their husbands die, or they're just given in charity. You know, in the the Chaitanya Charitamrita, there's the story of the these two brahmanas who went on pilgrimage, and the older brahmana was so happy with the service of the younger brahmana that he said, I will give you my daughter in marriage. Now, the younger Brahmana, he said, well, hold on a second, you're from a high-class family, I'm from a low-class one, your relatives will object to this. And what did he reply? He said, she's my daughter, I can give her to whoever I like, she's my property. Now, this is interesting, right? The father is considering the daughter to be his property. It's not very acceptable in today's culture to say such things. Actually, in one purport in the fourth canto, Jiva Goswami explains, the father can give his daughter in charity to another man on the condition that his daughter's son can be given back to him. This is one way you can give. You can give your daughter in marriage and say, I give my daughter on the condition that her son, you give her son back to me because I want another son. So Jiva Goswami explained this is perfectly correct system, Vedic culture. So anyway, when I was reflecting on it, I was thinking we have to really look at the mood. Now there's a statement in the scriptures, Dharma Rakshati Rakshita. If we protect Dharma, then Dharma will protect us. Now if we are trained in Dharma, if the ladies are trained in Dharma, then they understand that making such sacrifices, maybe marrying someone they don't want to marry, is actually good for them and in the long run. Now we in the Kali Yuga we find it difficult to understand these things. But we do see sacrifice. We sacrifice for maybe we want a particular job, so we may sacrifice, maybe go through 7-8 years of training, you know, education. Maybe someone wants to be a doctor, right? It's a lot of, you know, it's 7 or so years. So for a 7-year sacrifice, a person is willing to do that in order to have the career they want. So if we extend this principle, a lady will understand, I will undergo a lifetime sacrifice in order for a better destination. Because through, and actually it's understood that even through that sacrifice, one can be happy in this life and in the next. As Prabhupada explains that a woman will be happy if she serves her husband and pleases him. Now, even in the ninth canto, there's one example, Chaivana Muni and Sukanya. In this pastime, Sukanya is married to an old and irritable man, Chaivana Muni. And it's interesting to note that in this pastime, she actually comes out the winner because the Ashwini Kumaras come and they give Chaivana Muni a new body. So he has a very beautiful body. So she's followed Dharma and actually she's benefited. She then goes back to her father with Chaivana Muni, and her father thinks, who's this young guy you're with? You know, you're supposed to be married to Chaivana Muni. He chastises her and she laughs and goes, this is my husband, you know. He's got a new body. So we see this example. It's the woman actually benefits both in this life and in the next through this practice. I mean, this purport is an amazing purport. It's got all the things that, you know, you don't want to tell people about if you're not sure if they're going to like the Hare Krishnas. It's got polygamy as well. I mean, can you imagine? It's got everything in it. It's got polygamy. Women cannot be independent. You know, the Chanakya Pandit, he has this statement, Vishvasho naiva kartavya strishu raja kuleshu cha. One should never trust a woman or a politician. It's interesting to note, Prabhupada said this to Yamuna, but then he said to Yamuna, but you're not a woman, you're a Vaishnavi. It's an important distinction. Prabhupada is referring to a certain type of woman, materialistic woman. Now, I once heard a devotee say that the meaning behind this was that Chanakya Pandit had a bad marriage, so he didn't like women. So therefore, he said this. Once again, it doesn't quite work because I've seen Prabhupada quotes where he says, I am quoting Chanakya Pandit and he is an authority. What is the fault? You know, he would say like this. One Prabhupada disciple says that Srila Prabhupada was a PR nightmare. You put him in front of the camera. And imagine these American reporters, some of these, the feminist movement was taking hold and some of these female reporters, they were challenging and they were, you know, challenging Prabhupada and said, you know, you're saying that women are less intelligent, etc. And Prabhupada, he wouldn't give the right answer that they were wanting. He would actually play games, you know. One time, But actually, there is a bit of joking going on here as well. And some statements of Prabhupada, we have to understand in a joking way. Or even like, some would relativize the statements. For example, there's this famous thing he said. He said that men have 64-ounce brains, right? And women have 36-ounce brains. Now, according to modern science, this is actually not the case. But in Scottish Church's College, this is what they taught. So generally, devotees think that Prabhupada was just repeating what his professors were saying. But it's interesting to note, there's one, I can't remember, I think it was Kaushalya, one of the Prabhupada disciples' book distributors. She said, actually, even though he said that, he commented later on, but my female disciples, they have 64-ounce brains. They don't have 36-ounce. So there's a bit of joking going on with Prabhupada as well. So we have to understand it in this way. Anyway, let's go back to what we were talking about. Polygamy, yes. So polygamy, another thing it's not at all, it's not legal even. But the idea here is that, well, men and women, there's more women than men. Generally, there's a little bit more. And you also consider that on the battlefield, if so many men get wiped out, then that definitely leaves more women than men. Now, the point Prabhupada's making is that women need to be married, because if women are independent, that leads to, they're not protected, and it leads to degradation. What's the verse in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Adharma bivavat Krishna pradushyanti kulasriya stri shudushta suvarsneya jayate varnasankara. So this is the problem. Arjuna's picking this point, that when irreligion is prominent in the family, then the women are not protected. And when women are not protected, we get unwanted progeny. So the idea here is that marriage is based on proper... Women are protected, they're married properly according to the varnas, and you don't end up with varna shankara. The term varna shankara, it literally means the mixing of varnas. It leads to personalities that are not as qualified. So there's an idea that there's pratiloma and anuloma, different types of marriage. And there's a whole system that, I mean, it's not considered politically correct. It's like eugenics, in a way, like let's mix and match people according to how they're supposed to be. There's kind of this list that's going on. But it's supposed to be good because it leads to good progeny. So Prabhupada is making the point that if women are not protected, then they can be exploited. And factually speaking, we see in modern culture, as Prabhupada points out, women are not actually more happy now than they were before. Now, there are a few women that are more happy, because one of the problems when you have a very male-dominated society is that there can be abuse. If a man is not of good quality, then he can abuse a woman, and it's difficult for that woman to get out of that relationship. But we see now that is solved to a large extent, because the state is prepared to support women who don't have a husband. You know, it's not that, oh, the woman has no husband, therefore no one's going to look after her. The state will do that. So in a way, you can see this progression as it's humanity to allow a woman to get out of an abusive relationship. But ultimately, that's only one aspect. But in many aspects, that women are not satisfied now. For a start, that because there's more freedom in sexuality, it means that men are less obliged to commit. Therefore, they can exploit women. Or a woman that's had many partners, she's not so attractive when it comes to marriage. If a man thinks she's had many partners, then he thinks, well, I'll be the next one, but then I'm moving on. I don't want to marry this woman. So then women, they struggle to get a husband. So then when they're older, they don't have children and no one to support them. So you see there's so many problems with it. So it's only short-term vision that thinks that independence or sexual independence is a good thing. It's definitely not a good thing. So these are some interesting points. I thought I'd talk about another interesting aspect. What does a wife do? She's supposed to follow her husband. What does she do when the husband is of bad character? So what's the answer? Does she stick it out or does she leave? She leaves. So in this, there's one purport. Prabhupada says, if the husband has fallen, the wife may leave the husband. This is actually said. But he also said, but she should not remarry. This is the condition. So generally this is the idea that if the husband has fallen, the wife, ideally she should go back to living with the father, or if she has sons, she can be protected by the sons. But the point is, there's no obligation to stay with a fallen husband. There's another angle to this, though. In the Bhagavatam, there's an interesting statement where Mandodari, the wife of Ravana, she says, she starts explaining how Ravana is so sinful and how he will get a bad destination. And in the purport, Prabhupada explains, because Mandodari was a chaste wife and because she served her husband nicely, she developed jnana chakshu, divine vision, she had the eyes of knowledge, so she could see the faults of her husband. Why? Because she served her husband nicely. So that's another option. One can serve a fallen husband, and it's explained that one will actually become advanced, one will actually become spiritually advanced. So there's another aspect to that. Actually, the Prabhupada's sister, Pishima, she married someone who was not very spiritually inclined. He was a fish-eating Bengali, didn't have much spiritual inclination. So she would cook whatever he wanted to eat, then she would cook separately. Shishi Radhago Kulananda ki, Shishi Sitaram Lakshman Hanumana ki, Shishi Goritai ki jai. Yeah, so Pishima's, the arrangement was she would cook fish for her husband, then she would cook vegetarian food, offer it to Krishna because she was a Vaishnavi. So it's explained that she even had children, she was with this man. It's explained that later on in life, he had a change of heart. He realized, actually my wife, she was actually an irritable person as well, and sometimes he would pick fights. So it didn't look like a very nice marriage arrangement for Pishima. But as was very much the custom, she, in those days, she was very chaste and she just served her husband. So it's explained that later on in life, he actually changed and he realized that this woman I married is actually very exalted and I'm just very low. So he actually became spiritual just by the association of his wife. There's a very glorious example how the wife delivered the husband. So there is that aspect as well. So we have to consider these things. Another thing we're talking here about compulsory marriage of women. In the first canto, there's one statement where Prabhupada says, women should be married, compulsory that women should be married by the age of 16, and men should be married by the age of 24. So how old was Prabhupada's daughter, Elder Doyle, when she got married? Does anyone know? Now, Prabhupada's elder daughter was married at 16. He says that he was actually disturbed because it was so late. Prabhupada also explains that he had his sisters. Prabhupada had three sisters. They were married between the ages of 9 and 12. So one of the sister that was married at 12, Prabhupada explains that Prabhupada's mother was very disturbed. And she said to Prabhupada's father, if you don't get my daughter married now, I'm going to drown myself in the river. That was the age of 12. So Prabhupada's father was very disturbed that he didn't get his daughter married before the age of 12. Now Bhaktivinoda Thakur, his wife was married, was 5 when she got married. Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes this, it's like a doll's wedding. I think he was 11 and she was 5. So you see how things are. But you see, it's getting older as you go along, right? So now we have to look at this purport, married at 16, I mean, of course, in Britain, it's illegal to get married before 16. So if you're going to get married by 16, then you've only really got 1 year to do it in. So is this purport practical, Anyway, we see that the idea is that, the term is used, the Sanskrit term is kanyadan. And now, strictly, Prabhupada explains that kanya means, strictly speaking, it means before puberty. So the girls are supposed to be married before puberty. So, I mean, as I say, I don't, personally speaking, I just don't think this is very practical in this modern age, because women are individual now. They're brought up to be individual. It's like if you're brought up a certain way, you can't change. It's very deeply rooted. Therefore, because women are individuals, if you marry them to someone when they're before puberty, then when they reach puberty and they start having feelings, and they start to realize, well, you know, this, I don't like this man, I'm more attracted to someone else, then there's a problem. As I mentioned, I remember one example. This girl, she wasn't, she was maybe 15, and she was kind of, she was trained up to serve her future husband. This was in ISKCON. And then I remember as a group, this was in Poland actually, there were several examples, but this, the devotees were like really kind of, they respected this kind of arrangement. They thought this is the proper way to do it, and it was looked very nice. So she was too young to really make a decision herself, and she was serving this devotee who was maybe 7 or 8 years older. Then they got married, and then just there was no love there, and then she ended up running off with some other person. And it's just, but now both of them are married to someone else, as far as I know. So we see that it didn't work, and I'm thinking why it didn't work. It's not that the system doesn't work, it's just that the system has to be there in full. You can't just suddenly take a Western person with a Western upbringing and suddenly try and force them to follow some system that doesn't work, because you have to be brought up a certain way. But in that particular Vedic system, it's very, very nice, and we also have to consider the consequences of not following such a system. So in our society, to have a relationship outside of marriage is not such a big thing. It's quite common, or to have sexual partners before marriage, it's almost considered normal, and it's considered recommended almost. Like, oh yes, you should try and see if you're compatible. If you're not compatible, then don't get married. So you got to experiment first, and then if you like someone, you get married. But if you get married before you've experimented, then, well, maybe it's not going to work out. And there's all this kind of philosophy. But this is based on a lack of understanding of the laws of karma. You know, I mean, if you read the fifth canto, you know, the description of what happens to those whose sexual practices aren't proper. The man has to embrace a red-hot form of a woman and vice versa. So you can see this is very, severe punishment. But if you don't believe in this, as modern society doesn't believe in this, then there's no big deal in having sexual relationships outside of marriage. But our acharyas, they can understand that the hell, they can see, they have the divine vision, they can see the hell that people will suffer through this practice. Therefore, they're more strict about, let's protect the woman, no sexual relationships, only one husband before puberty, etc., etc. This kind of restriction is actually beneficial. It saves people from going to hell later on. And actually it leads to freedom. You know, in the second canto of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a statement, Atma Vashayar Videyatma Prasadam Adigachati. It said, those who follow the regulative principles of freedom, they obtain the mercy of the Lord. It's a lovely statement. It's kind of a contradiction. Regulative principles of freedom. Think about it, right? It's a contradiction. Freedom and regulation, they don't go well together. But actually, this is actually the understanding that through regulation, we get freedom. So through a very regulated culture, I mean, it looks like slavery, but it's not. It will give freedom. And actually, this we're talking here, this verse, this purport, it's all about how women should be restricted. But actually, the whole men and women, everyone is restricted in Vedic culture. You notice that? One time, it's interesting to note, and when Prabhupada is talking about the Sahamarana, the Sati rite, he explains, he wants this mood to be present in ISKCON. He actually says in one purport, the ladies in ISKCON, they should be prepared to die for their husbands. And then he goes on to say, and everyone should die for the spiritual master. He says, one should be prepared to fulfill the order of the spiritual master or die with the spiritual master. This is what's lacking. You know, sometimes we wonder, well, why the movement isn't spreading. But if you look at the difference in attitude, when Prabhupada was here, the surrender that people went through for Prabhupada was amazing. People would risk their lives. They'd do all sorts of amazing things. There's one example in India. There was one Pandal program. Someone shouted out, he said, a member of the audience, he shouted out, Swamiji, you know, why are you preaching Sanatana Dharma in India? You should be preaching in Pakistan. Prabhupada shouted back, is this a challenge? The man said, yes. So Prabhupada, he then sent Brahmananda and Garga Muni to Pakistan. Now, there was a war going on at the time. So Prabhupada wrote to them and said, actually, it's not a good time to go. But they'd already left. They didn't get the letter. So one of them flew to Pakistan. The other one went by land. They actually had a brahmachari assistant each. So they got to Pakistan. There was a war going on. It was the middle of summer, and it's one of the hottest places in the world. People were spitting at them. And they split up. One was in East Pakistan, one was in West Pakistan. So there's four of them there. Each, they both had a brahmachari assistant. News then came out on the newspapers that four Hare Krishnas were killed in Pakistan. So the devotees, they read this and they thought, oh no. They thought, okay, this is Brahmananda Gargamuni and their assistants have been killed. But actually it wasn't. I don't know who it was, but they were still alive. And finally they managed to make it out of Pakistan. Didn't seem that the preaching was very successful. And then Brahmananda, he went straight to Prabhupada, who was probably in Bombay or Vrindavan at the time. Anyway, he came, and in Prabhupada's, you know, Prabhupada's thinking, well, maybe they've been killed or something. Prabhupada saw Brahmananda, he was so happy, and he gave Brahmananda a big hug, you know, and Brahmananda never forgets this moment, the love he felt. But anyway, this is an example of the risk that devotees would take in the service of Prabhupada. So he wanted all his devotees, you know, this is the mood, to serve the spiritual master, one should be prepared to die. And we have the example from our yatra with Tribhuvanath, you know, such a great sacrifice, going to Africa, he gets malaria, and he's passing out, but he's just dedicated to preaching. He fell over, you know, smashed his head, fractured his skull. And he was there with Giridhari. Giridhari got assaulted, you know, broken jaw, he was in hospital, so, you know, couldn't eat for 6 weeks or something, eating out of a straw, etc. You know, this kind of sacrifice. But you notice these devotees that they do this sacrifice, and when you see them and you see their mood, there's something about them I love Giri. Giri's mood, he's got this really nice surrendered mood about him. But I think it's due to his association with Tribhuvanath, and Tribhuvanath was so inspirational as well. So we see this example that actually this idea of surrender, whether it's the wife surrenders to the husband or the husband is surrendering to the guru, this is the essence of the Vedic culture. And if we do that, then dharma rakshati rakshita. We follow dharma, dharma will protect us, and we get a higher destination. So we can understand. So, I mean, obviously, a lifetime. We're asking a lady for one life to serve her husband, even though she doesn't like him. But then think of the long term benefits. She gets elevated either to the spiritual world or to the heavenly planets. So I'll finish with one little quick story from the Mahabharata. So when Pandu, remember the story, Pandu, he was cursed that if he approached his wife for sex, then he would die. So one time, you know, Cupid got the better of him. He was in the forest, and Madri was there, and he became attracted. So he approached Madri, and he died. So then, what to do next? Madri's lamenting, Kunti's lamenting. Now, Kunti was a senior wife, so she had the right to enter the fire. And they were fighting. Madri was like, no, I want to enter the fire. Kunti was saying, no, I want to enter the fire. And Madri, as I say, because she was senior, she could have, but she decided she would be compassionate and she would allow Madri the good fortune of entering the fire. And so her mood was, I will enter the fire because my master, he wanted to enjoy with me. I will go to the heavenly planets and I will fulfill his desires. And besides, Kunti was thinking, Madri will never, she'll always feel guilty that Pandu died, because if she remained on this planet and looked after the Pandavas, then she'd always feel guilty because Pandu was approaching her, and so he died because of her. She would think this way. So you see the difference. You see they're fighting. It's not like they were fighting over, I want to live, I want to live. No, I want to go with my husband. See the difference. So this is it's another world. Vedic culture is another world. But Prabhupada, he's making, actually in this purport, like twice he says, this is Vedic culture. This is Vedic culture. Hare Krishna. So, I hope I didn't offend anyone. I'm not going to try and deconstruct the scriptures in order to try and present Prabhupada in a way that he isn't. He's very, very clear on this point. Anyway, anyone got any comments or questions?